ayes. OAE, all persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Lincoln Plains, draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. To my left is Judge Lance. We're here today in the matter of Egbert versus Nicholson. It's docket number 062773. With counsel for both parties, please note your appearance for the record. Begin with you, counsel.
Daniel Mack for petitioners in this case.
Who's with you there?
Sean Sprecher.
Thank you.
Thomas Sullivan and Randy Campbell for respondent.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Mr. Mack, you'll proceed first. You may reserve time.
Thanks. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
All right. 5 minutes it will be. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, this court's statutory authority to compel action of the secretary unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed was designed precisely for cases like this. For nearly a decade, Wiccan veterans have sought simple equality and burial benefits.
Excuse me. Before we go into the history, I'd like to be clear about a couple of things on the facts. The petitions were lengthy and the materials were helpful, but I want to clarify exactly what applications that we have before us. There are a number of petitioners in the caption of the pleadings. Now, by my recollection, the ATC slash Davis have filed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 particular applications or documents with the department seeking to have the Pentacle placed on the approved list.
Is that correct?
Okay. And what they're seeking is to have the Pentacle placed on the list.
That's right.
Okay. CNI has submitted one application, if I'm correct, seeking essentially the same thing.
Correct.
Actually, two, I think. They've renewed that, right?
I don't think they have. I think it was January 05.
And what about the January 06, none?
That was the renewal of ATC.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so, okay, now, then we have three individual appellants?
Correct.
Okay, that's Mr. Stearns. Now, tell me about Mr. Stearns.
Yeah, so he's actually a member of ATC, so in that sense, he has been part of the application process since
what
ATC.
Is he applying for?
And he is also applying for recognition of the Pentacle on the approved list.
Okay, so the relief he's seeking is Pentacle on the approved list. And now Ms. Egbert slash the Coyman, I guess it is, application. Tell me about that.
So that application, she was aware that there had already been a number of applications on file for recognition of the Pentacle. She herself filed a formal application in September of 04. She then...
And what was her application for?
That was... Actually, it was her mother that originally filed that application. Her mother, Rosemary Kuhlman, filed that application on behalf of her deceased husband, Abraham Kuhlman, who was a veteran who served in World War II. And he died in 2002.
And what was her application seeking?
Her application was seeking recognition of the emblem and its use on her husband's grave, which is in Arlington Cemetery.
Okay, so she filed an actual VA Form 401330 seeking the application of this symbol, which had not been yet approved, on the headstone.
For use on that particular headstone, yes.
Okay.
She then appended that application to ATC supplemental application in 2006 and added some additional information as well. And then she has since passed away, so her daughter is the petitioner in this case, who is next of kin.
Has she filed any application, the daughter?
She has not.
Okay, and how about the Howe application?
That was filed along with the supplemental ATC application on behalf of Ms. Cornelison's son, James Price, who died in Iraq.
Okay, and who filed that application?
She filled out the application, but ATC facilitated it and submitted it with their supplemental.
Who is the applicant?
The applicant is Petitioner Cornelison. Okay. Patricia Darlene Howell Cornelison, who is the mother of
And she's
James
seeking
Price.
The application of the symbol on Mr. Price's headstone.
That's right.
Okay.
And when was that application filed, please?
That application was filed in 2006, January 06.
Okay, a little over a year ago.
That's right.
Thank you.
So if you take all of these together, the first application for recognition of this symbol was filed nearly 10 years ago, and during this entire period, the Secretary has consistently refused to act on any of these applications for emblem recognition, even as VA repeatedly granted that same basic benefit to veterans of other faiths. We think the time is long overdue.
Assume for a second that the Secretary were to approve the church's application and or deny the church's application, actually give you an answer. And you filed an NOD and they allowed the process to go to the board. Assume that happened. How do you get into this court?
This court would have jurisdiction to hear...
Under what authority?
An appeal of that under the authority that it has to review decisions by the Secretary under the definition 511. Any decision by the Secretary addressing a decision...
Addressing?
That's the board. That's the board's jurisdiction.
That's right.
Take me to the court.
Okay, so if the board has jurisdiction, then this court has jurisdiction.
All right,
to
how
review,
do you file an appeal?
To review the decision of the board.
Take me to 7266 and tell me how the church gets in here.
So I assume you're asking about the standing question?
I'm asking about how the church becomes a person adversely affected by the decision.
And Your Honor, we recognize that the decision...
Well, no, I'll tell you, there's two issues under standing. One is an organization that comes up here on an extraordinary writ and might seek the authority of this court to allow its members to come in. That was decided in the case. The other you're arguing also is that the church, by and of itself, is entitled to a decision because the church is somehow adversely affected. If you accept all of that, how is the church a person? Under what authority do you equate the church to a person under 7266?
Well, the church is a claimant in the sense that it filed a claim of the sort that was approved by other institutional organizations. So if you
can... We're agreeing it's an institution. How does it get to be a person? I mean, there are statutes out there that define persons, parties, et cetera, et cetera. What do you see in Title 38 or anywhere that would equate your church or organization to a person?
I think that the court can read person to include any claimant who filed an application below.
No, isn't that now you're getting me into big arguments. The court can do whatever it wants to do, but where do we derive it from? I mean, just because I sit here and say, gee, I want to determine a church as a person, I guess we can write it in there and it becomes law. I don't know, but normally you follow it from, bring it from someplace. Where am I bringing it from? This statute specifically says person. How do you get there?
Right. Again, I think person can reasonably be read to include that. If it doesn't, however, the standing in this case does not depend only on the standing of the churches. The individual next of kin undoubtedly have standing if this court has jurisdiction otherwise, and I think VA concedes that point. So,
take me to those two. Let's say you have Egbert and Cornelison. Both of them filed, one filed in 04. And clarification, was that application in 04 simply to have the emblem approved, or was it for the headstone?
It was for the headstone.
Okay. So we have an application back in 04. This is 07.
That's correct.
All right. What's the time period in which you say that there's a refusal to give you a decision?
Well, if you focus only on that application, it's a little under 3 years.
Okay. And then the Cornelison is a little over a year.
That's correct.
And recently the Secretary has said to you, we're going to give you an answer. We just want to complete this reg.
That's correct.
So why would you get extraordinary relief from this court?
Because if you view the situation as a whole, the application process has been going on for a while. There courts view the question of unreasonable delay applying a number of factors. The D.C. Circuit in the track decision 750 F. 2nd 70, for example, lists a number of factors, including a rule of reason. They point out that longer delays are less tolerable when we're talking about human health and welfare. And there's no...
Well, let's say we get beyond the fact that the 97 is involving a church and not an individual and not a particular headstone, and the same with the CNC. Let's say we apply the delay in giving you a decision. The Secretary has recently come out and said, we're going to give you one, as I understand it. We're going to give you one. We just would like this regulation to be in effect. So what extraordinary relief would we say?
Well,
give you one before it comes into effect?
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, it may take several years. It may take longer than that. The Secretary has not committed to any timetable. And in fact, I don't think the Secretary can statutorily do that, commit to a timetable. It may take up to a year, it may take longer, merely to get the regulation out. But once that happens, there's absolutely nothing in this proposed regulation that imposes any time limits on the Secretary. In fact, the only time limit in this proposed regulation is the time limit on applicants. If they are told that their application is somehow deficient, then they have 60 days to correct it. But the Secretary is under no obligation whatsoever to do that.
Once this regulation is put into place, would the Secretary have to assess the application under both processes, the regulation under which the application was first made in 04 and 06, and the revised regulation?
I think that the Secretary is currently under an obligation to assess the applications under the current regulations. It's a common understanding in administrative law that until a new regulation is put out there, the existing one applies. Under that existing one and under the pre-existing one, so the 05 and the 01, these applications clearly met all the criteria, and in fact, during the time when these applications were pending, the Secretary approved numerous applications, several of which, at least five of which, were submitted by institutional applicants alone.
So you're asking for an answer on the application under the current regulation so that you can process whatever the decision is that they give you?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And what we have here is every day veterans of other faiths are passing away and they receive this benefit. The benefit is not available to Wiccan veterans and is not available.
Counselor, let me interrupt you for a minute. How is listing in and of itself the Wiccan Pentacle a benefit under the veterans benefit system?
Well, first of all, for the two next of kin, it's not merely listing it, putting it on the list. It is also putting it on the headstone of their deceased veteran relatives. So that is clearly a benefit. As to whether putting the emblem on the list generally is a benefit, I think we have to go back and look back at the statute. And Section 511 talks about decisions by the Secretary under a law that affects benefits. And I think there is no doubt that this arises under a law that affects benefits. The Bates case makes clear that the question of what is a law relates to a single statutory enactment, in other words, a public law number. And in fact, BVA regulations explicitly list jurisdiction for burial benefits and burial benefits and burial in national cemeteries, and that's in 38 CFR 20.101.
But for the sake of argument, I will concede that granting a headstone and burial itself is probably a benefit under the system. Okay, but the act of listing a particular symbol, how is that a benefit?
Well, it is either a benefit or it is certainly under a law that affects benefits. The Secretary promulgated this list pursuant to his statutory authority. We are not, just to be clear, we are not raising any challenge to the initial discretionary decision about what categories of information to put on there. But the decision about what categories of information can go on headstones is certainly within the ambit of Section 511, and the decision about what goes on that list, it certainly falls under that as well.
Since September of 2004, how many symbols did the Secretary, to your knowledge, approve?
To my understanding, they have not approved any since September 2004.
And that was the date of Mrs. Koyman's application, or Egbert's application?
That's correct. That's correct. But again, she was aware that there were pending applications for this symbol, which would have immediately been able to have been used for her husband. And during the small period from 2002 to 2004, the Secretary approved a number of applications which were in no way different in form or substance than the applications it already had on file, other than they were submitted on behalf of other faiths. And so what we have here is what is effectively a constructive denial of the application, because if the Secretary had denied those applications, then at least they could have been appealed. But instead, the Secretary has been sitting on them and has been giving assurances to all of these applicants over the course of these many years that, don't worry, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. We're coming out with new regulations. They've said that time and again. And as they've been saying that, they have not been conveying any of that information or any of those requests to the exact same applications.
Let me shift you to Stearns. Let me shift you to Stearns. He is, he wants to have it approved so that he would know that it could be on his headstone at the time.
That's correct.
It became appropriate. The Secretary's rules seem to indicate that an application to have it on the headstone. Does he actually have an application in to have it on a headstone in advance?
He does not. He just
so he's just saying, I want that symbol on there.
That's correct.
And why would he have standing to ask to have a symbol on a list to begin with, even at VA?
Well, it's true that under the current regulations, that is to say the 2005 regulations, there's a requirement that there be showing of an immediate need. So he would not meet that requirement. But what he would meet is the requirement that was in place, A, as of the time that he submitted his application, and B, that other similarly situated.
So March 05, anybody could walk into VA and file an application, draw a little symbol, and say, put this on your list, and the secretary would have to give them an answer that could be appealed to the board, that could be appealed to this court, and that's your position?
Yes, subject to the regulations that were in place at the time, the 2001 regulations from Directive 3310. Those regulations were tightened and clarified in 2005, but in any event...
Was that after March of 2005?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Okay, so what you're looking for is an answer, saying, Mr. Secretary, you owe us an answer. And you can tell me no because I'm not a veteran. You can tell me no because I'm not dead. You can tell me no because that drawing of that symbol, you're the only person in the world that has it, and we just don't want to approve it. But give me a reason so I can appeal to the board.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the 2005 regulations lay out the criteria in even greater detail. And these petitioners filed their applications both before and after those regulations were in place, and they are in place today. What the Secretary is asking for when it points to its new regulations is for further delay. That would be one thing if we were operating from square one, but we're not. We're operating under a situation where everyone else was treated differently, and these veterans were denied even a decision on their claim, on their application. And it is very clear that this court...
They don't even need to be a veteran under the theory.
That's right, although, again, we do have next of kin of veterans as well.
They don't even need to be a next of kin under the theory. You could be anybody who walked in and filed a request to the secretary saying, I want it. And then the secretary has to decide whether you're entitled or not.
That's right, Your Honor. Assuming you meet the various criteria, assuming you show that your religion has the
I want to get to it. You're saying they have to give you an answer. Maybe you don't show anything, but the answer has to be given by the secretary.
That's correct.
And it may be no because you don't show anything.
Correct.
Because you're not a veteran. Because you're not whatever the reason is.
That may be, uh-huh. Yes. But again, if at the time the secretary had decided we're not going to give this to the churches because they're not veterans, well, again, first of all, the churches have veteran members. But second of all, VA has given that very same benefit to other applicants who are just institutional applicants who said, I'm Church X, here are the number of adherents I have, this symbol is widely acknowledged to be the symbol of my faith, etc. And VA never went back to any of those applicants and said, you know what, you're not a veteran, I'm not going to act.
So not only is the secretary not processing it, he's not processing it because he's being discriminatory in violation of the Constitution.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the cases are clear that to show unreasonable delay, you do not need to show impermissible motive. I think the effect here is one of impermissible discrimination. That's not to say that is the reason behind the inaction. We, frankly, don't know the reason behind the inaction. But any claims of a burden on the administration of this system just would make no sense in light of all of the other approvals. I mean, that is I think, one of the damning facts here for the Secretary's position. If it had not approved applications during this period, that would be one thing, but it has. So it is very difficult to swallow any claim that
although since September of 04, when the Egbert family filed, there has been no approval of a new symbol, is that correct?
That's correct.
So there is no discrimination with regard to approval of symbols since 04.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think you have to factor in the fact that VA has already approved 38 other symbols. I mean, the number of new symbols that are going to be proposed is...
Do you know if any other applications have come in since September of 04 besides this one?
I don't, Your Honor. And on the question of the board's and this court's jurisdiction to hear a claim that a denial of such an application would violate the Constitution or violate some other federal statute like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, I think that the statute, the cases, and legislative history are all clear that there's absolutely jurisdiction to hear this claim.
And, Counselor, you alluded to it earlier. It's your position that as a result of the Bates case, the Federal Circuit Court indicated that this court gets involved in the nuts and bolts of Secretary's decision and the VA's decisions. Is that the essence of your argument?
Well, it's something like that. It's not the nuts and bolts necessarily. For example, it would be a very different question if the Secretary had never made the decision and the Secretary's delegates had never made the decision to put this category of information on headstones at all. I think the statute does afford some discretion to the Secretary to decide what other information goes on. But the important thing here, there are two sources of boundaries for those decisions. So it's not going to be asking this court to micromanage what's going on. But number one, it's a basic principle of administrative law that an agency has to follow its own rules. And the Secretary has issued several rules in this case, and they would be held to that standard. Number two, it is also absolutely clear that the Secretary would be bound by the Constitution and other federal statutes. So beyond that, merely a finding that this court has jurisdiction is not to say that this court should micromanage in any way, and there may be a very deferential standard of review to the decisions that the Secretary made. But one thing the Secretary does not have discretion to do is to apply its own regulations in a way that is has the effect of being discriminatory in violation of the Constitution and federal statutes. In fact, the Secretary has conceded as much that treating Wiccans differently than adherents of other faiths, whether by denying or by declining to approve their applications, would contravene the Establishment Clause. So the question is, did they do that? That would be the question on appeal in this court.
With regard to the applications to be placed on the list, that is ATC, CNI, and the Stearns application, what relief would you have this court give to those petitioners? How would you phrase our order if you were successful?
That the Secretary, within some specified time period, 30 days, shall act on the applications that are currently pending before it.
And with regard to the individual applications for the headstone, what relief?
It would be the same thing, to act on those applications. The beauty of all of these claims is that they're quite simple. So this is not a question of micromanaging the details of complicated benefits calculations. This is something that takes a very short time to do, a yes or no decision that the Secretary has already demonstrated in a number of other cases can take a couple of months. And once any of those petitioners, the next of kin or the other ones, received their approval, then that would end the matter, because then they would all have that approval. Once it's on the list, then the individual next of kin applicants could simply check that box off. It would be symbol number 39. There's nothing complicated about what we're asking here. And with that, I'd like to reserve my
remaining. You want to add that to your 5 minutes?
Yes.
All right.
Is that possible? Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Once again, Thomas Sullivan and Randy Campbell for respondents, Secretary of Veterans Affairs and National Cemetery Administration. Your Honors, I'd like to take the argument a step back. I realize that petitioners have brought a very compelling claim before this Court. However, they have not satisfied the threshold inquiry as to whether this Court actually has jurisdiction over the matter. Respondents would submit that without an answer to that inquiry, that the Court cannot go forward.
Could you address that in two tracks? First, the applications to be placed on the list, which I think are the ATC, CNI, and the Stearns application. And then secondly, the application of the individuals for the headstone markers themselves, where there's been an application for those headstones actually filed.
Mm-hmm.
I see those as personally factually different. Could you explain? Do you see those as different? Let me ask you that question.
Yes, actually I do. However, I believe your question, Judge Hagel, goes more to the standing of the parties than the actual subject matter jurisdiction over the entire matter as a whole. And until the respondent would assert that until we can really answer the question as to whether this is the right forum to hear this dispute, that your question would be a little untimely. However, you are the judge, so I...
If you prefer to answer it in course, I'm happy to wait.
Okay. Quite simply, Your Honors, we believe that the petitioners have brought their case to the wrong courthouse. And there's a couple of reasons why we believe this. First, they filed their suit, or their petition for a writ, pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act, the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, and the Free Speech and Establishment Clauses of the United States Constitution. They did not allege that there was any delay on the part of the BVA. Their alleged error was that the secretary delayed in a decision that they loosely alleged that the BVA would have jurisdiction over. Now, as this court well knows, it serves a very important, but albeit limited, function over review of benefits decisions by the BVA. We would submit that this question, the question of whether additional content can be included on a government-provided headstone or grave marker, is not an appropriate question for the BVA and is not a question that affects a question of benefits.
Now, Counselor,
go ahead.
Where should have the petitioners brought their petition to request that the Secretary give them a response?
Your Honor, I believe the proper venue would have been the United States District Court. That United States District Court would have original jurisdiction over actions brought under the Administrative Procedure Act, the Religious Freedom of Restoration Act, and also the Constitution.
Well, you're familiar with the Bates decision?
Yes, I am.
This court, until the Bates decision came from the Federal Circuit Court, shared that view, that possibly jurisdiction lies somewhere else in terms of the administrative decisions of the Secretary. But the Bates decision is fairly clear, at least as far as I'm concerned, in joining this court, that we are now involved in some of these decisions made by the Secretary. Can you address that for me, please?
Yes, I would be happy to, Your Honor. The Bates decision can be read a few ways, and certainly at a first reading, it appears to provide a very expansive view of this court's jurisdiction. The Secretary would submit that a close review of the decision shows that that's not necessarily the case. And if you'll bear with me for a second, I'll try to elucidate. The Bates decision very specifically was the Federal Circuit was trying to resolve whether particular subsections of a statute which had been held to affect benefits, therefore would then affect the other subsections. In other words, would the other subsections that didn't necessarily affect benefits, would they then be subject to jurisdiction? And the court said that you couldn't read the statute in a vacuum. You had to read it as a whole. And if certain subsections had been held to affect benefits, then even though they held the particular subsection in question before them didn't, that it would. Now, I would submit to the court that the statute in question today is 38 U.S.C. 2404, which grants to the Secretary broad executive authority to maintain, develop, and administer a national cemetery system. The additional inscription clause falls under Chapter 24, and therefore no part of Chapter 24 is involved with a benefits decision.
Is a veteran entitled to a headstone?
A veteran is certainly entitled to a headstone. However,
is that a benefit?
It's a very interesting question.
Does the BVA, if a veteran was denied a headstone, made an application for a headstone, was denied a headstone, could the veteran appeal to the Board of Veterans' Appeals?
Yes, he could. Okay. Absolutely.
All right. And where does the authority to give the veteran a headstone come from?
The authority to give the veteran a headstone actually lies under Title 23, and I believe it's provision 2306, which actually grants the benefit of entitlement to a headstone or grave marker at government expense. Now,
law was that?
The public law, it was the National Cemeteries Act. And
what public law was titled Chapter 24? Was that a different public law?
No, it's the exact same public law.
What part of the Federal Circuit decision in Bates that said it's governed by public law are we not understanding?
Well, actually, I was getting to that, and I'd be happy to answer that. The Federal Circuit, as you know, zoomed out and took an even more expansive view of what would constitute a statute that affects benefits. And they look to the public law. And the public law question here is the National Cemeteries Act of 1973. And yes, there are two portions of that act that discuss whether or not a veteran would be entitled to a government-provided headstone or whether a veteran would be entitled to be interred or buried in a national cemetery. To that extent, there are two benefits provisions in the public law. However, in Bates, the court gave itself a caveat. It said that our holding will not affect all statutes that affect provisions of benefits. And further, it ended its opinion with a very specific charge that it would not affect any statutes that are subject to the jurisdiction of other tribunals. So we would respond, Your Honor, that the Administrative Procedure Act would be the appropriate way to challenge the Secretary's discretionary or executive authority.
Well, if we found that this was a matter that affected benefits, if that was our decision, then we would have exclusive jurisdiction over that, correct?
That is correct.
And then no district court would have jurisdiction.
No, that is correct, and I could actually get to your other question.
And then,
that would be the next step.
And then how do you explain the Sixth Circuit's decision in Beeman?
The Beeman case also... similar analysis in Beeman. In Beeman, the district court, the Sixth Circuit held that the district court did not have jurisdiction because the claims raised by the Beeman plaintiffs specifically affected their benefits claims. They were actual compensation claims before the agency, which this court certainly has jurisdiction over. So even though constitutional issues were raised in that argument, the appeals court for the Sixth Circuit believed that because of this court's unique authority and jurisdiction, that they would be better. This court would be better suited
Not just better suited. We would be the only court that could entertain that.
That is correct.
Right. So, yes. Going back to my sort of original premise here, it seems to me that based on this discussion, this whole issue about whether we can act or not turns upon the question of whether or not we find that either of these two groups of petitioners are asking for something under a statute that affects veterans' benefits. Is that correct? So that's really the narrow issue that we need to decide. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
Now, are you ready to get to my initial question?
Sure. Assuming that you decide that this is a question that affects a provision of benefits, then you would have to address the standing issue, and I think that's really where your inquiry comes from. Essentially, the Secretary would submit that Petitioner Stearns and the petitioner churches lack any standing before this court, and the only parties that would have any potential standing would be Mrs. Egbert and
Why
Mrs. Cornelson.
Why Stearns?
He's a living veteran, and the entitlement to receive...
He may not be entitled. You may be able to tell him no. It may be sustained, but why can't he submit a claim that gets a decision? We have claims that come up here all day long that say the person is not a veteran. Well, actually, we don't get too many, but once in a while you get them. You decide they're not a veteran. We have to review it.
Well, Your Honor, he can't establish one of the main principles of standing. He can't establish that he has any injury in fact, because... any injury, in fact, would not arise.
I thought the injury they were claiming is that he doesn't have a decision. I think the difference here is you can say no, but they're asking for a decision. Say no because he's not a veteran. Say no because it's not an approved symbol. Say no because he's not deceased yet. Aren't they asking for a decision?
Well, they come collectively and ask for a decision.
Well, but I'm breaking them out. We were trying to break them out. You have the churches, and you have Stearns. You've left off Egbert and Cornelison for a second. We'll come back to them. I'm just wondering why Stearns is in the boat with the churches.
Well, there's different reasoning for why both parties lack, or both groups lack standing, but they all lack standing. Your Honor, before the court could even decide whether or not they were entitled to a decision or enjoin the secretary to make a decision, which is the secretary's exclusive executive authority to make the decision at a time that he feels is necessary, the only way the court could do that if it were satisfied that it had subject matter jurisdiction and that each of the parties did have standing. And so each of the parties would have to come forth and show that they had some sort of injury in fact. In other words, you can't just come in and say that you're entitled to a decision. You have to show that you're actually entitled, legally entitled to a decision.
So you have to prove your claim before you can file your claim?
Well, I think in this context, with the writ of mandamus, it's a very high threshold, a very high standard. And I think...
But isn't that difference, isn't that whether we grant the extraordinary writ as opposed to whether they can come before us and ask for the extraordinary writ?
Well, before they get through the courtroom door, I think a few important threshold questions have to be answered. And one of them is, what, sir, really is the harm that you have suffered? And do you have a legal right to the remedy that you're asking me to give you? And I would submit that
I thought you came in the courtroom door and said, I filed a claim with the secretary. The secretary said no. He's been saying no forever. It's effectively, constructively a denial, and I think I'm entitled to a decision. That sounds like what they came to us. Now, the result might be that if you answered it, it might be no. It might be affirmed by the board. It might be affirmed here. Who knows what's going to happen? The result in extraordinary relief might be no, because when we look at this, this isn't a case for extraordinary relief. But it wouldn't be we don't have standing to decide it. You're saying because we might say no, because you're not entitled to extraordinary relief, you don't have standing. I don't think the two go together, do they?
Well,
first question is standing.
I think they kind of do go together. I think the jurisdictional question, and I also believe the standing question in this particular court, given the given the limited nature of this court's jurisdiction, it does make a rather circular. It is a rather circular argument. And if we go to the
only question is he entitled to a decision that could be appealed to the board, and is he a person who can file in this court?
And I would submit that he is not, Your Honor.
Which is he not?
He is not entitled to a decision by the board on the question that he presents, and therefore he would lack standing to bring any plea before this court. And we would seek that the court dismiss him from the petition.
Well, let's talk about the two deceased veterans and the families thereof. And tell me what more you need from Ms. Egbert to provide her an answer respecting her father, Abraham Clayman. More do you need in order to make a decision?
Your Honor, I not being the Secretary's delegate, I'm not certain in the past why...
Wait, excuse me a minute here. You're not the Secretary's delegate, but you're the Secretary standing right there. Okay, so you're the representative of the Secretary. What you say, we're going to take as the Secretary's word. So,
sure, surely.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out that I'm not the one who makes the decisions as to which emblems of belief are, which applications are approved or disproved or set aside to be pending.
Understood.
What I do know is this. I do know that the last emblem of belief that was approved was in March 2004, and that was the Sikh emblem of belief for a deceased Sikh veteran. Mrs. Kuiman's application on behalf of her husband, who is buried in Arlington, was received in September of 2004. She later passed away, and her daughter, Mrs. Egbert, steps in her shoes.
Okay, but please respond to my question, which is, what more does the Secretary need to make a decision? There's the pentacle that's been presented in terms of the symbol of belief, and the Koyman family has indicated we would like to have this on the headstone, which we perceive to be a benefit for our departed father, who was a World War II veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What more does the Secretary need to make a decision?
I'm not certain that I can answer that question.
All right. Let's talk about PFC.
Let me just interrupt. Can you ask your senior counsel if he can answer that question? This should not be a surprise to you.
I'm not surprised.
Your senior counsel and see if he can answer that question. Take a moment.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would just like you to understand, I'm not trying to refuse to answer the question. We are, as you know, the Secretary is promulgating a regulation to establish criteria where they would be able to decide on a more accurate basis each application that comes through. To that extent, that's really the best that I can answer your question.
Yeah, and then ask me, excuse me, but tell me what more you need from Mrs. Corneliuson, whose son was killed on September 18th, 2004 in Iraq. What more do you need other than her application to give her an answer in a family closure?
Well, Mrs. Cornelison's application is complete, and the determination that Mr. Price is entitled to receive a government-provided headstone has been determined. He is entitled to do that. The question of whether, or entitled to receive that, the question of whether the Wiccan emblem of belief will appear on that headstone, at least at this time, has not been decided. And the Secretary, in 2005, the General Counsel instructed the Secretary to begin a formal rulemaking process to determine or to establish criteria by which to follow Congress's mandate under 2404C1, which admittedly was very belated. And the Secretary is complying with Congress's intent and is in the process of issuing a rule, which will then provide criteria.
Aren't there criteria already? I mean, you're going to fine-tune the criteria. I understand. I believe I understand that.
Sure.
There are current criteria. Applications have been approved. This one is sitting there and is in limbo. But there are current criteria. Couldn't the Secretary say no? You don't meet it under the current criteria. Let them appeal it. Let the board say they don't have jurisdiction. Let that whole process go.
I mean, if you believe that you have subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honor, and you believe at least one of the parties has standing, yes, you can absolutely direct the
well,
Secretary
forget
to
us
answer
directly
that question.
And couldn't the Secretary give an answer? There are criteria upon which you can give an answer.
That is correct. Yes. He chooses not to at this time. He's waiting for the publication of the final rule, which...
But even if you publish a new rule and regulation, wouldn't it have to be assessed under both? Assuming there's jurisdiction, assuming it's a matter affecting benefits, assuming the board has jurisdiction over it, given the case law within veterans' benefits, wouldn't the application of either Egbert or Cornelison have to be assessed under the regulations in effect at the time the application was submitted, or the revised regulation, whichever is more beneficial?
Well, the previous directive, yes, that's a correct statement of the law, yes.
The previous directive, if I understand it correctly, has not been withdrawn. Its application has been suspended, I think is the term it uses. Am I correct?
Well, rescinded, actually.
Yes,
okay. The Secretary has withdrawn the criteria that was in place prior to initiating the rulemaking process.
Is there a date by which the Secretary would commit to having published the new regulation?
Yes, Your Honor, to the extent that I could commit to a date, I would submit that the final rule appears that it will be published probably within the next 60 days.
Within the next 60 days?
60 days, maybe a little longer. It's ongoing. It's going. The final notice and comments have been received. The final rule is going through the executive department process at this time.
Okay.
And we look to publish in June.
Now, assuming that the regulation was published in June, is the Secretary prepared to commit to a time period in which they would make a decision on the applications? In essence, all of these deal with the application of the approval or disapproval of the pentacle as one of the approved symbols.
Yes, Your Honor. A decision on all applications would be issued forthwith.
And, well, I might have a different view of forthwith than you do. Can you be more specific than forthwith?
Well, certainly the new regulation has a provision in it that speaks to the fact that a decision has to be made, that entitlement arises at the time of need, and the idea that there is a need, an immediate need, to honor the particular veteran in his death, his or her death, and that the Secretary will issue decisions on all pending applications. There are also other religious groups who have applications pending at this time before the Secretary.
Right. Well, let me get back to my question again. Is the Secretary prepared to commit to a specific time in which the application for the Pentacle to be placed on the list would be decided?
I believe that he would, yes, Your Honor.
And what would that time be?
I believe that once the final rule is issued, within 7 to 14 days after issuance of the final rule, the Secretary will issue a decision on all pending applications.
Okay, so in that case, given your other time frame, we're talking about, at the outside, 90 days from today, then the petitioners could expect a decision on the applications, either the individual ones or the applications that actually have the symbol placed on the list. Am I correct in understanding?
Sure, because essentially they're all applications. The viability of each application certainly is each one is viewed individually. That's correct.
Now, has the Secretary communicated that to the petitioners?
The Secretary has not. No.
Should the petitioners consider this a communication to them?
Yes, they can consider it.
Thank you.
Your Honors, unless you have any other questions for me,
What's the Secretary's view in light of the time period just given to the court as to whether or not, assuming there's jurisdiction, standing, et cetera, the court should grant extraordinary relief?
Our position is certainly you know where I stand on jurisdiction. Basically, we don't. Justice Kennedy, writing in the Cheney case recently, did a lengthy analysis of what it would take to get a writ. And he pointed out that it is the most extraordinary remedy in the judicial arsenal and should be used very sparingly. He pointed out that the petitioners, the moving party, has to show that they have no other adequate means to obtain relief. We would submit, Your Honor, that they do, that based on my averments today, and based on the fact of their knowledge that we do have a final rule that's going to be published, that they would have a decision coming soon. So they do have other relief. Also, have they shown that they have a clear and indisputable right to the writ? Your Honors, the petitioners initially aver that they've waited 9 years, but when we look at the close facts, we see that some of the petitioners have only waited a little more than a year. Now, I'm not going to make any excuses to you that any delay is an okay delay, but there's certainly a dramatic difference between 9 years and 1 year. So I'm not sure that all the petitioners have even shown that they have a clear and indisputable right to this writ. The last point that Justice Kennedy brought to light was that a court, in its judgment, must look at all of the circumstances before it resorts to such an extraordinary remedy. And the respondents would submit today, Your Honor, that given the fact that the Secretary is attempting to comply with Congress's intent by establishing regulatory criteria, and we are so close to completing the formal rulemaking process, that the court would, in its judgment, abstain from issuing a writ at this time.
I'd like for you, if you could, to, I'm not sure that with all of the our interruptions of you, I want to make sure I completely understand your position on this, whether or not we're dealing with a matter affecting benefits. Okay. Mm-hmm. So with regard to the group that's asking, the group of petitioners that are asking that the Pentacle be placed on the list, do you believe that that application to be placed on the list is something that involves a law affecting benefits over which we would have jurisdiction, or the board would have jurisdiction?
I would submit that it is not, that it is not a law that affects a provision of benefits. In fact, specifically, when the statute was codified, it's noteworthy that the benefits provisions were put in Chapter 23.
Okay, so you're basing this on where it's placed in that it's not within the particular chapter that would accord benefits.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, the Secretary has broad executive authority to maintain the National Cemetery System. Mm-hmm. So that authority, while it does extend to each individual veteran, also extends to all veterans and to the American people at large. And to the extent that a decision, if this were a decision that were able to be adjudicated by the board, for example, the petitioners, if they didn't like the decision, could appeal to this court. As this court knows, the secretary, if he did not like the decision of the board, could not appeal. So the secretary would lose this broad executive authority that he has to maintain the national cemeteries as national shrines. I think that's just a little fact that speaks to the, I realize this jurisdictional issue is really fine. I realize we're on the head of a pin. I understand that.
So in other words, and I understand what you're saying, but in essence, taking your argument into consideration, what we're looking at is the scope of Bates with regard to the National Cemetery Act of 1973.
That's correct.
Okay.
Let me just, I'm sorry.
Could I pursue this?
No, I thought you were done.
Now, with regard to the individual petitioners, is there a different, for the individual headstones, is there a different analysis? A different reason why the secretary believes we either would or would not have jurisdiction? First of all, do you say that you don't believe we have jurisdiction, I take it? Or no, do we have?
I do not believe that the court, I would submit that the court does not have jurisdiction to consider the matter in the
first
instance.
Is the reason any different in that case than in the individual petitioner case than in the people who just want the pentacle to be placed on the list?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I see that I have 5 seconds left, so if I may.
Feel free to answer.
Thank you. No. In a word, no. We believe that this is not a matter that would be subject to board review and therefore not court review.
But you said before in response to my questions that if an individual was denied a headstone, they could appeal that to the board and the board could render a decision.
That's correct.
Then we would have jurisdiction over that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Then if somebody applies for a headstone really only has meaning based on what's on it, correct?
Well, I think that goes to the heart of the matter of the secretary's argument.
So if the secretary, are you saying the secretary has absolute discretion and therefore we don't have the ability to review it because the secretary has absolute discretion?
No, we do not believe that the secretary has absolute discretion. We believe that he has broad executive authority. However, the authority to review the secretary's discretion would lie in an Article III court.
But the only authority the secretary has that I see according to the statute is to establish regulations. And I think as the petitioners argue here, look, we're not saying that you can say no symbols of belief on the headstone, but the law requires you to establish regulations about what will be there. And once you establish those regulations, well, they're actually asking you to establish the regulation. Once you establish the regulations, that becomes part and parcel of the benefit package of the headstone.
I don't believe that it does. The secretary would submit that it never does, that any additional content that the secretary by regulation shall so prescribe under 2404C1 would always remain within the secretary's broad authority administer the cemetery system. And if you'll bear with me one moment, I understand that it would seem that the content of a headstone would be uniquely linked to the headstone itself. But it's not exactly. If we look at where Congress didn't intend in this circumstance for that to be the case, would be a better way to phrase it. If we look at 23, I believe it's 2306, which is the provision that discusses entitlement to receive a headstone, it specifies that the next of kin can ask if they would like a granite marker, if they would like a slate marker. There are certain invitations to the next of kin to participate in the memorializing process. At all times, however, with a view at all times that this memorial will be a part of a larger memorial and a larger site, and that is essentially why the content, or the secretary believes that the content is not.
Well, let me
interrupt just a second. How much time are you counting the time he's going over? Are you counting how much time he's gone over? All right, I'm going to say it's about 5 minutes. We'll continue. Would you please count the amount of time he's going over? As long as the judge has a question, we'll continue. We'll add it to your side.
If an individual, say, was of the Jewish faith, and by mistake, a Christian symbol was placed upon the individual's headstone, and the next of kin says, hey, We want the symbol of the Jewish faith on the headstone. And for some reason, the secretary said, nah, sorry. We put it on there, we realize it's wrong, but we're not changing it. Would they, would that individual have the ability to file a claim with it? Well, to have that appealed, to file a Form 9 and appeal that decision to the board?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe that that exactly would happen. If the next of kin came forward,
I understand you. You believe
if the next of kin came forward, we actually do have a program within the National Cemetery Administration to correct errors. Now, assuming you're hypothetical for the sake of argument, that any action on that, the secretary would submit, lies within an Article III court. It would not be subject to BVA review.
Counselor, if I may, you're linking the National Cemetery system with the benefit of a headstone. And isn't it true that I can be buried subject to permitting on my farm if I choose to and still receive the benefit of a headstone?
Well, I'm not certain if you can be buried on your farm, Your Honor, but you can be buried in a private cemetery. That is correct.
All right. So even though you've now have linked the National Cemetery system with the headstone benefit, the two are really two distinct theories and operations. Isn't that true?
Well, I think it is true, but I also think that you have to also look at how Congress created the National Cemeteries Act, and you want to look to what Congress was looking at and how they shaped that act. And what they were doing was creating a nationwide cemetery system. The idea that one could take the stone outside is something that came later.
Thank you.
I have one question. You're suggesting that Chapter 24 is somehow separate and not included within the jurisdiction of the board. It's not benefits.
That's correct.
What does 20.101 say? Burial benefits, burial in the national cemeteries, 38 U.S.C., Chapters 23 and 24.
That is correct. So, and that is because the status question, the question of eligibility for interment in a national cemetery is I think 2402. At 2402.
So 24 is not totally excluded?
No, I've never said that. What I said was 2404 as a statute is completely exclusive.
So just 2404?
Right. And
not,
the only
not chapter 24.
Yes, Your Honor. And the only portion...
And the regulation doesn't exclude that, though. You're presenting that. The regulation specifically includes Chapter 24.
It would appear to.
All right. I have no further questions. Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. How much time do we?
14 minutes and 20 seconds.
You may have 14 minutes and 20 seconds, although you do not have to take it all.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't intend to. I'm just going to say a brief word on the jurisdictional question and then turn again very briefly to the question of unreasonable delay. First of all, on the jurisdictional question, as Your Honor just pointed out, the statute makes clear that it would be improper to parse 23 from 24. But more importantly, Bates makes clear that you can't do that anyway. The view of what the relevant definition of a law is that the VA puts forth right now is flatly rejected by the Bates decision. It's one actually that's advanced by the concurrence in Bates, and the majority expressly rejects it and says that the law is not a statutory provision. A law is the public law under which it was passed. I think that's absolutely clear.
What about the section in Bates that counsel's referring to that the majority said it doesn't apply to everything?
That section is immediately followed by an illustration of what those exceptions might look like. And to be clear, what we're talking about here are exceptions to the general rule. Those exceptions would apply in situations that are not applicable here. First, the court mentions that there would be no jurisdiction possibly if there is no formal decision by the secretary or his delegate, and that's not the situation that we would have here. Again, the secretary would make a decision. The secretary's delegate would make a decision, and once again, I turn to the BVA's regulations governing jurisdiction. They specifically contemplate that a notice of disagreement will be filed with the NCA, with the National Cemetery Administration, and that's in 38 CFR 20.3. So that's number one, when there's no formal decision here. This is an application. It asks for a yes or no question. The secretary would give a yes or no answer. Secondly, the other narrow exception recognized in Bates is where there is a federal statute that confers jurisdiction on some other tribunal. And the examples they give are for contract disputes or employment disputes, and we just don't have that situation here. Turning to the question of unreasonable delay, first I'd like to talk about the representations made today by the Secretary as to timing. The Secretary has made representations in the ongoing district court litigation about similar claims, and those are not quite the same timetables that were given here. And this was in a January 25th, 07 estimates given by the acting deputy undersecretary of the NCA, which were approved by the undersecretary of Memorial Affairs. And that was once the proposed regulations were published. They would accept comments, and that would be till March 20th. From that point on, here were the estimates. First, they would have time. They would need time to review and analyze comments and make policy decisions. The estimate they gave there was 1 to 3 months. Then they would have to draft the final rule. The estimate again given there 1 to 3 months. Then internal concurrence and revision 1 month. Then OMB review 1 to 3 months. Then final revision and publication of the final rule 14 days. That takes us even under the lowest end of each of those. That takes us past June. Secondly, that all depends on the Secretary deciding that the proposed rule should be similar to the rule that they finally publish, and that will depend on a review of, for example, the comments. So there's no guarantee of that. That's the hope, that's the expectation, but there's no guarantee.
If I understood the Secretary correctly, he said that they've received all the comments, they've redrafted the rule, and it's now in, I'm assuming, at Office of Management Budget or someplace like that. It's in the approval process to be published, and it was intended to be published within 60 days. That's what my notes reflect. Now, do you have a different understanding, or is your understanding based upon whether it be the deposition or the affidavit or declaration filed in the district court case?
Yes, my understanding is based only on the latter.
Assuming that we take the Secretary at his word expressed today that the petitioners would have a decision within 90 days of today's date, how would that affect your view of whether or not we should grant the petition?
Well, number one, I would hope, and I'm not sure it was clear, maybe it wasn't, maybe I missed it, but I would hope that representation would be a reference to a decision on pending applications, in other words, applications pending today. The draft regulations as they were written would appear to require reapplication. Obviously, we could do that fairly quickly, but I would hope that was a representation about a decision made on pending application.
But of course, your applications are all pending.
Right. But I wonder, I'm not sure it was clear what pending meant. But okay, in any event.
Why don't we just get it clear?
Sure.
Counsel, would that include the pending ones, the 14-day estimate you gave after the 60 to 90 days passed? Or would they have to reapply?
I'm sorry.
Would the decision to be made in the 60 to 90 days after the regulation is put out and the approximately 14 days to make a decision, would that apply to pending claims, or would they have to reapply?
Upon my knowledge and belief from the cemetery.
It would include pending claims.
That's correct. Okay, well, I welcome that representation. That 90 days or something of the like is certainly better than indefinite, and it's certainly better than 9 years. But I still think it would be insufficient. And what we have to look here is the question of what it means to have unreasonable delay.
Well,
there is no per se rule.
In the course of addressing this, and I'm going to let you do that, counsel for the Secretary makes, I think, an important point that an extraordinary writ is just that, extraordinary. And taking the Secretary at his word, in 90 days, you will have a decision, which is all you're asking us for, is to compel the Secretary to issue a decision, and within some specified period of time. So in that context, this is where we sit now, different than when you walked in the door, I understand that. Why is it that we should still grant the petitioner's relief?
I think the relief should be granted even under that time frame. And again, as an aside, I'm not sure what relief petitioners would have, what immediate relief petitioners would have available if the 90-day promise were not met. And I certainly take the Secretary at his word, but that we can't anticipate all eventualities. But assuming it were 90 days, I think it would be still unreasonable, and we would still be entitled to the writ. The question of how long is too long for these purposes, there's no flat, hard and fast rule about when the time has gone too long. But I would point the court's attention to a recent decision by the D.C. Circuit, American Rivers, which is at 372 F3rd 413. At 419 of that decision, the court said there's no per se rule, but, quote, a reasonable time for agency action is typically counted in weeks or months, not years. And importantly, following that, the court found it gave significant weight to the fact that the delay in question was, quote, uncharacteristic of the relatively swift treatment routinely given similar petitions. And that's what we have here. Again, we are not starting from square one. We are starting in the context of...
Yeah, but reality is... The Secretary has come in here and said, in about 90 days, you will have a decision. What would we grant you, 30 days instead of 90? I mean, what you're arguing about is spilt milk. In your view, you've been denied a decision. But the Secretary came here today, and I'm not saying whether this is good practice or not, just a matter of fact, in about 90 days, you're going to have a decision.
Right. And with respect, Your Honor, to the grieving families of these deceased veterans.
Now, I agree. I'm not arguing. But the fact of the matter is, what do? Issue an order that takes us how much time to get out that says you get 30 days instead of the 90 the Secretary has given you? This is extraordinary writ now. This is what's happened. This has happened in front of us. Is that good practice? I'm not going to go there. But that's what you're faced.
Right. Well, in any for whatever the additional time is that the petitioners' families have to wait for this, during that same time period, veterans of every other faith that has been recognized on the list are entitled to this benefit. And it is just additional time. I recognize a couple of months is not nearly as bad as a couple of years, but I think the weight should be assessed in a cumulative fashion as the courts direct. If there's nothing else from the court, I have nothing further.
All right. The case will be submitted. Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel.